Good morning, good Machi, and welcome to the inaugural show of Good Ancestors and Local Treasures with Corrine Pierce. Sintamana, Ana Pikabitam Day. I am your host, Keishi Corrine Pierce. Since this is the inaugural show of Good Ancestors and Local Treasures, I want to take a moment to share a bit about myself. I'm a local Pomo basket weaver. I'm a traditional artist, herbalist, dancer, storyteller, and cultural educator with ancestry from Lake and Mendocino County tribes. I've had the honor of being featured in numerous news articles, art galleries, and museum exhibits all over the United States. I was recently a guest presenter at the 40th Annual EcoFarm Conference, which I'm very proud of. I am the author of the book, Pomo Cradle Baskets, An Introduction, and have been featured in the PBS program Craft in America, the California episode. I'm a 2020 Jennifer Easton Community Spirit Award recipient, as well as the 2020 Inaugural Luce Indigenous Knowledge Fellowship Fellow. I was most recently a presenter for the Northern California Tribal Court Coalition and a guest speaker on the radio program Native American Calling. I'm currently a featured artist for the California Indian Conference 2020 Digital Exhibition, California American Indian Culture and Art as Pedagogy, a Teaching and Learning Exhibit. I'm honored that you're joining me this morning to take a closer look at some amazing people, places, and events that make our home in Mendocino, Lake, and Sonoma counties unique and rich. I'm grateful to be able to share some of my personal heroes, who happen to also be some of the most influential movers and shakers in our local indigenous community. Yawi Tochima, thank you for listening to Good Ancestors and Local Treasures with Corrine Pierce on community-supported KZYX. So, we are going to spend the next hour discussing the jewels. And I'm sorry if I'm not going to say this right. I'm actually going to ask one of my guests really quick to help me out. How do you say his last name? Jules Tavernier? Is that right?
Tavernier.
Tavernier. Okay. French. So the exhibit is called Jules Tavernier and the Ilem Pomo, and it's going to be coming to the De Young Museum in San Francisco from December 18th through April 17th. So I'm super excited to have the privilege to speak with three local treasures from our indigenous community who had a big role in the creation of that exhibit and how it is being presented. So I'm super excited about that. So the exhibit is centered around a painting that was created in 1878 titled Dance in the Subterranean Roundhouse at Clear Lake, California. So I'm going to read from the San Francisco Chronicle. It was an article that was out last month talking about this exhibit. And it's really in depth. It's going to take a couple of minutes, and then we're going to talk with the people who helped create that. So Tavernier, yes? Okay, my French is not the best. While in San Francisco, Tavernier spent 2 years visiting the Ilem Pomo Indian village at Clear Lake, California, while preparing to create the painting Dance in a Subterranean Roundhouse at Clear Lake, California in 1878. The painting depicts, and I'm going to actually ask Robert if he can to say the word for the people's dance. You know, he speaks Eastern Pomo and I speak Northern Pomo. I'm sure it's very close. I think it's Mfum Ha, but I'm not. Hey, okay, Mfum Hey, or the people's dance, which is a sacred ritual to the Ilem Pomo that takes place in an underground roundhouse known as, okay, Robert, Hechuan. The dance was performed as a protection ritual for the land and peoples as new settlers brought diseases. The painting was commissioned by a San Francisco banker as a gift for his business partner, Baron Edmund de Rothschild, and was shipped to Europe upon completion. Despite its immediate transit to France, local newspaper accounts of the time call the work, quote, by far the most remarkable picture ever painted on the Pacific coast, end quote. The painting was purchased by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 2016. The exhibition at the D. Young will be the first time that the painting has been on the West Coast in 140 years. Christina Helmick, the curator in charge of the Arts of the Americas, Oceania, and Africa for the Fine Art Museum said, quote, "The exhibition looks at his work in a new way that makes it perhaps more important," end quote, noting that Tavernier's inclusion of indigenous people in his landscape was itself unusual for the time when other artists were presenting scenes of the American West as open and ready for settlement. Tavernier actually shows indigenous communities at these historical moments when they are being displaced or when their communities are really under tremendous stress from settler incursion, genocide, and displacement. The exhibition will include additional paintings, prints, watercolors, and photographs by the artist, as well as depictions of the Alem Pomo by Tavernier's contemporaries. Ceremonial regalia will also be on view, along with examples of Pomo basketry, an art form they are renowned for. Through the partnership that we have with Pomo curators, scholars, and cultural leaders, we are not only bringing perspective about indigenous representation, but also issues about indigenous sovereignty and land, said Christina Helmick. The exhibition will also feature a documentary made by the Fine Art Museum, bringing contemporary Alem Pomo perspective to the work. The film highlights the history and culture of this community as it existed when Tavernier was allowed to paint and record their ceremonies. The destructive impact of industrial mining on the community in the late 19th and 20th centuries and the ongoing legacy of that impact, end quote. So again, that was from the San Francisco Chronicle. The article was entitled Jules Tavernier and the Alem Pomo. Again, that's coming to San Francisco D. Young, December 18th. So that's done, and I'm right on time. So welcome to my three amazing folks here who had a hand in creating that upcoming exhibit. So with me today via Zoom due to COVID, we have Robert Gary, who's an Alem Pomo cultural leader and regalia maker, and he is a captain of the Roundhouse. He's actually my cousin, so bragging a little bit. These people are really important to me, so I'm really, really proud and happy that they are on this inaugural show today. So we also are joined by Sherry Smith Ferry, who is a renowned Dry Creek Pomo scholar and a personal hero of mine. And if you listen to this show in the future, you will hear me quote her repeatedly. I also am joined by a good friend, Mio Marufo, who is another personal hero, a great artist. And when I grow up, I want to be Mio. So she does a lot of really cool stuff. She's one of the most talented creators of things that I know. So I love her very much. I love all these people very much. Welcome to Good Ancestors and Local Treasures, guys. So it's important to me to represent indigenous culture because I am an indigenous woman. And it's very important to me that everyone in our community knows how amazing and outstanding these people are. We have such a rich and diverse community that I am aware of, and I'm so honored to be able to share it. So I want to start with Robert. Robert, if you can introduce yourself, and then I have a few questions for you about the exhibit. Sherry shared with me that you were the first person that the curators contacted about doing this exhibit. Can you tell me what that was like?
Robert Gary, how's everyone today? My name is Robert Gary, and I'm from Alem. This kind of came up. Did you want to do introductions first with everyone, or and then go through the questions? Is that how you wanted to?
Are you feeling like that sounds good to you?
Well, yeah, I just kind of figured that's kind of what we were going to do. But no, either one. I mean, the answer to the question, I guess, is it was actually, it came across in an email, like, I can't remember. I want to say like in 2017, actually the head of the linguistics department, somebody emailed her and said that they wanted to know more about the painting. That's the very first time I saw the painting. And yeah, it was amazing. You know, I wrote the preface actually for the program for it. It was an eye-opening, experience to see something just so grandiose, I guess. I stared, for a long time at it, looking at all the details and intricacies, I guess, that he caught, which were really good to see, the material from the environment that he used, kind of really, goes along with, a lot of the traditional knowledge, that our elders had talked about how these, structures were, created. So, it was nice. It was good. And then, I also, kind of being a regalia maker, you look at all the details that really aren't so great. Yeah. So I kind of did that too.
Yeah, it's definitely a interesting picture. I've never seen it in person. Have you been able to visit the?
Oh, yeah.
And it's huge, right?
It's actually in the American wing, where it's in the same room where Washington's crossing the Delaware.
Oh wow!
So it's in a really profound room that's there at the museum. So yeah, it's
well. So these are almost like life size ancestors that you're looking at.
Almost. I mean, it is a pretty big picture. The painting is pretty huge. So
that's exciting. So I read in the same article in the Chronicle that you said that it was kind of it's a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that? If you could elaborate on what you meant.
Well, on one hand, it was good to be able to have a reference to history, I guess, with, like I said, collaborating and kind of comparing, I guess, all the things that you've been told along the way. A French painter actually puts it on canvas, right, to see like how grapevine was used, see how, the poles were used, how they were, tied. And then just the bringing together of the people and seeing like the women. It's really, when you look at it, that's the first thing that really kind of stands out to you. It's actually just this big, it's like we're here, right? And it's all women. You see the two guys that are dancing in there and you see everybody around, but really the thing that sticks out first is just the long line of women. And that right there for me was like, I felt proud to see all the intricacies. I think that was... put into their regalia, but then on the same sense, I mean, you see the, the banker and, the one that was, people that came along with Tavernier that are in the painting, especially the guy from the mine, who's actually, opening up the mine and really causing a lot of destruction to the environment and to the people. And so it's kind of like a little bit of both, you kind of see there. And then you, like I said, you kind of look at, the painting itself and you see, there's some inconsistencies. And then there's some embellishments from, other, I think, paintings that he has done where, there's a lot of big gold hoop earrings from the Midwest or, those kind of things where it was just to make, I guess, more grandeur, I guess, of a painting, but that wasn't indicative to us. We didn't have that type. It would have been abalone and clamshell and pine nuts and all those things that we wear today. But so it's got like I said, a little bit of both in there. So
yeah, I definitely noticed some Iroquois inspired style of jewelry in this picture. It's really interesting to look at the painting, because I did notice the same thing. It took me a while to notice that there were only two men dancers. Because I was looking, there's so much stuff going on in this painting. It's just amazing. So what did you contribute to the exhibit?
Well, I think as far as just to the painting itself, a little bit more knowledge, I think, of what was really going on, traditional knowledge. I think, you know, that was I went back in 2000, I think it was 19, and I was actually in New York for a linguistics conference. And while I was there, I said, hey, I'm going to go by the Met and check this painting out in real life, right, and go and see it. And it was it was amazing to see because of how big it was. But then I got to read the panel for it. And, you know, no pun to, you know, anyone that's outside of California, but the panel was written by somebody who was Ojibwe, talking about the roundhouse that really didn't understand or didn't really kind of have that connection with it. So to read that, that kind of got under my skin a little bit, you know, because it's like, you know, I think we're always looking at indigenous people. As long as you get one, he can speak for everyone. And so that was just one of the things that really kind of, like I said, kind of got under my skin. And after I got home, I actually emailed the curator and just kind of told her how I felt and, you know, some of the things, I guess, that was going through my mind about the painting. And then that's kind of how it started.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. So I want to move on with Sherry. We're all going to answer some questions a little bit later, but I would like to ask Sherry to introduce herself. Tell us a little bit about you, and then I'll ask you the questions about the exhibit.
Sure. I am honored to be on your inaugural program, Corinne, and I'm delighted that you're doing programs. So I'm...
Thank you, Sherry. I just adore you. I would do anything with you. I'm just going to have this radio show so I can talk to you every month. Let's make an appointment every Monday.
Oh, no. We could just pick up the phone. So I'm actually from Sonoma County, so Dry Creek Pomo and Coast Miwok. And I came up here, goodness, about 25 years ago, 30 years ago now, to become director at the Grace Hudson Museum in Ukiah. So I've done that for quite a long time. I remember taking the job and thinking, oh, you know, I'll stay 5 years.
I'm glad you stayed longer than that.
And I recently retired, and I'm going, you know, now I'm working for my tribe. Doing cultural projects for them. So I can talk a little bit about how I got involved in the exhibit. I was getting ready to retire, and it's a really busy time, and it was also around Christmas. And for some reason, I checked the spam folder on my computer, which I never do. And there was, along with other things, there was a message from somebody that had a Met Museum address. And I thought it was probably from the store because I've bought some Christmas gifts from the Met gift store before. And I thought,
fancy.
Oh, I wonder if they have some specials. And I clicked on it, and it was from a woman who was curator at the Met, who planned to be in town in January and wondered if she could come by and look at the museum and talk to me. So I often think that, you know, that was meant to be somehow. That of all days, of all times, I would actually follow up my spam folder. So they came through. I think they met with you first, Robert. They had just, this was the two curators of the show who are both American painting specialists. So this was really conceived in that framework. And they were looking for potentially pieces and some potentially help to frame the kind of more native side of the exhibit. And we should say that this exhibit was co-produced by the Met and the De Young, and that it is now currently at the Met. It opened, I think, about 3 weeks ago now. And so if anybody is going to New York and wants to see it, I think it'll be there until the end of November. So that's how I got involved. And I was asked to help them with the basketry, because that's really my area of specialty, the kind of the basketry side of things in the exhibit. And well, I think one of the things we should say is this painting is done in 1876. But he was kind of going to the community around 76. So you know, that's really in the history of contact, you know, that's pretty early. And there was a lot, it was a very interesting, heartbreaking and interesting sort of time period for Pomo peoples everywhere. But particularly here, it's just so interesting to see this kind of moment of kind of cultural encounter, and to be, you know, now I have to do math, which I'm not good at, but, you know, almost 150 years later, we know more what the reverberations of that kind of encounter that you see are going to be. And so it's, you know, I think there was a number of things I think all of us contributed to the development of the exhibit that wouldn't have happened if we weren't there. But we can talk some about that later. But I know one of the things that people from that were involved from the two museums that were involved in developing the exhibit wanted was contact with somebody who was contemporary artist, as well as knowledgeable, you know, about sort of traditional arts. And so I couldn't think of anybody better than Mio. So I think that's how Mio came on board. And
what a great introduction for Mio.
So I'll turn it over to Mio.
All right. Welcome, Mio. It's good to see you. Beautiful face. So how'd you get involved with the project?
I have to live up to these introductions, guys.
You do.
I kind of just fell into it. I really feel like Sherry gave me a call and said, hey, I have these people coming over, they're talking about the Tavernier painting. Do you want to come help me? And let's look at baskets and let's look at Eastern Pomo stuff. And even though, you know, it should be said, this is a Southeastern painting. Robert, you didn't get to fully introduce yourself, but it's an Eastern Pomo painting, or Southeastern Pomo painting, and I'm Eastern Pomo, which is the other side of the lake. But, you know, because we all live on that lake, you know, there's a lot of similarities. I will say, you know, there's a lot of differences also, but there are a lot of similarities. So I got to come over to the Sun House when they were looking at items, and we just basically... it almost felt like we tag teamed them. You know, we just kept answering questions because we wanted to put more of the cultural items in with the painting to truly show this painting. You have to add in so many of the cultural items to explain and lead up to the painting. I think also my environmental background has helped, just in talking about, you know, some of the effects of what happened. But really, I believe that the three of us coming together and adding all these different elements to this painting and all the different cultural items have led to a fuller story of what this painting is. Because if you were to just walk upon this painting and look at it, yeah, like Robert said, and like Sherry said, it's magnificent. It really is. And your first impression is so proud to have a Pomo painting in the masterpiece world. That's it's a very powerful thing to know that your people affected the world at large on the art world. And then you do start looking at it and you do start seeing the Iroquois headdress and the Southwestern things. But that was more indicative of the time of just, you know, an artist trying to sell their work too. You know, they add those little pieces so that it's more palatable to the world at large, because they're not going to understand those flicker bands. They're not going to understand some of the plainer skirts that our women had. So they gussied it up and used things that they knew about Indian country. And I think bringing those cultural items that we have and surrounding that painting with it, and looking at the baskets that are inside the painting and all the different elements, and putting the actual items in there and trying to get it around the same time frame that this painting was made, really creates this story that when people walk in there, they not only see this painting, they see the people. And I think that really, between the written panels that Bob and Sherry did, and to the baskets that were chosen, the regalia pieces that were chosen, this is an experience that we created to introduce a little bit of who we are to the world. The Met Museum is an international museum. The De Young Museum is an international museum. And we have created an opportunity for people to look inside the world of Pomo.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. I'm so proud. You know, I love this painting, and I actually cannot wait to see it in person, because you guys talk about the baskets that are in. Of course, I'm a basket weaver, so I go straight for the baskets. But you talk about the baskets that are in there, and I know Robert said that there are different kinds of baskets in there than would normally be in the roundhouse. And I have been in the roundhouse a lot. I've grown up in the roundhouse since being a little kid. And the cool thing about this painting is that, coming from that culture, you know, like seeing the door where it is, I can feel myself in our roundhouse in that spot. You know, like I can smell the smoke, I can smell the dust. But it is weird to see it so romanticized and kind of like, here's the whole village, let's shove it in the roundhouse so everybody can see it all at once, which is kind of weird. So I did want to talk to you guys, so all of you, about the baskets that are in the painting, because I haven't seen it, so I can't see up close what baskets they put in there. And also, Robert, if you don't mind sharing, what would the difference be between a ceremonial basket in the roundhouse and the ones that are in the painting?
Well, I know, and there are a lot of things. And the reason why I think I like, even with the documentary that was done for it, is that there's a lot of history, not only just for the cultural items and the things that we did as Pomo people, but also just the history of ceremony itself, which, you know, even I think some of us as, Native communities, like especially these younger dancers really don't know its origination, right? Like where it originated from and how and why, right? And so I think a lot of that information is there. You know, some of the things I think that was passed down, you know, from our elders of, you know, how the roundhouse came, how it began and the reasoning for it, I think, and all that's in there, you know. And so for me, I don't know, I look at like even the painting, when I see it, you know, the baskets, there are certain ceremonies that we used to have that I haven't seen, you know, done in a long time. And they were, you know, basically baskets that were used for singing and doing things in the roundhouse. And basically it was for, you know, making sure that we got acorn, you know, that following year. And so there were baskets that were made for that. There were baskets that were sung in there that were used. And those were the only ones that, you know, we were taught about. The other things, you know, they were, you know, everyday implements that we used. And, you know, they weren't something that you would take down in there unless like it was, you know, and I see the tray there. And the only thing that I can imagine with the tray is that, okay, well, it must have been, you know, midnight snack and people might be bringing something in to put on it. But, you know, as far as the burden basket and the other ones that were in there, that wouldn't have been something that would have been in there. It would have been in the house, you know, in a home, but not in a ceremonial setting. And so, like I said, you kind of can see some of those things that are being embellished, which is, you know, I'm glad that it's there because, you know, for non-Native communities to see that, it's just another, I guess, item or I guess another piece of what really what makes Pomo Pomo, right? I mean, that's what we're world renowned for is just really the baskets, you know, and I think for this, that was one of the reasons why I really wanted to, like, you know, be a big part of telling the truth. I've seen those old dresses and, you know, the dress that the women are wearing, they're nice. They're really beautiful, vibrant colors. Mio and I have seen those, you know, dealing with NAGPRA. And they're just as beautiful. You know, they're not the turquoise. They're not, you know, but they're the basic, you know, white, red, blue, black, yellow, and made out of flower sacks, but beautiful. And so, you know, I think it's that trueness is what I'm hoping people will really understand and see.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm really loving the painting. Because I'm, of course, I assume everyone knows that Pomo basket weavers were the most amazing. And when most people think about Pomos, they think basketry. And that's just my opinion because that's what I think. Our baskets are incredibly impressive, but I think that this painting really shows that not, you know, impressive art like that can't just come from nowhere. It has to come from an impressive culture. So this basket or this painting really makes an impression on that. And I think that that's a really cool thing. I also want to point out a couple of things that when Sherry was talking, she mentioned that this was early contact for California natives. And a lot of people don't realize that even if they are living in California, this was only 150 years ago. And that was our early contact. So we're, still here. We're still thriving. This wasn't 500 years ago. This wasn't 300 years ago. This was 150 years ago. And I know a lot of people in their 50s, you know, when they were born, it was only 100 years ago. So we're going through a lot of transition. I'm so proud to see that museums are asking Indigenous people to come and start to represent themselves. And I know because I've seen it from the outside. But I know that as Indigenous people, when we work with entities, we still have to work within their frame of what they are going to allow to be shown. And I'm wondering if you guys, I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but I'm wondering if any of you would touch on that, touch on what it's like to be edited, to be censored for what you can put into the museum or what they are willing to include, if any of you want to talk about that. Yay, Sherry.
I'll start that discussion anyway. It was interesting to it was interesting because working with people who understood paintings, but did not really know. So I would say one of the really remarkable things about this exhibit, and one of the reasons I'd encourage people to go, is because you'll see some really beautiful examples of regalia, which is in terms of an art form, I think is as equally remarkable as Pomo Baskets. And for anybody that knows me, people know that I adore Pomo Baskets. So I think it's a chance to see something that is transitory in nature. I mean, so much of it is made out of feathers and things that you know, baskets are really made out of sturdy materials. I would say regalia, much less so. And so, and then it's usually just brought out for particular occasions. And so it's not on view the way baskets are. So it's, and I think it is this, there are also pieces that are meant to move. The one thing that I'm sorry is that they couldn't be in motion, you know, when people see them, because they really are at their best. They're really designed to be hands. And it tells you, I think between the baskets and the regalia, it gives you a picture of a people that, first of all, knew the world around them very intimately, because, and they were very, they had an eye for beauty, and they had an eye for I don't know how to even explain it, but it was just that whole concept of beauty, I think, permeated just life. So you have, instead of, I would say, one person, in this case, Tavernier, who is a great artist, I would say you have a community of people that were great artists. And it's kind of a chance in the exhibit to see those two particular kinds of art forms, art worlds, sort of being merged for a while. And I remember talking to the people in New York saying, because we did go round and round and round about baskets, in my case, and Robert smiling. I know you probably went round and round about regalia too. They were like, well, let's just use this one. And it's like, no, that's not right. That's not from the right time period, or that's not the right sort of thing for this particular circumstance. So I think people didn't know in the museum world, they didn't know really the kind of variety and the depth and the maybe the nuances of it all. I think they had more of appreciation for that. But I also remember telling them, you don't understand. You know, people are going to be coming to see the baskets and the regalia because it, the painting is nice, but people are going to be coming to see the baskets and the regalia because they will never, you know, not many people ever have a chance in New York to see that. And it needs to be right. And when it is, it's remarkable. And I think, you know, I think they were thinking that we were kind of an afterthought in some ways. So I could be doing them a disservice, but I think their main concentration was on the painting and ours certainly wasn't. So I don't know, Robert or Mio, if you have anything you want to say.
I'm just going to interrupt and say welcome, everybody, for listening to Good Ancestors and Local Treasures with Corinne Pierce. We are talking with Sherry Smith-Berry, Robert Gary, and Mio Marufo about their involvement in the Jules Tavernier and the Alem Pomo exhibit that's coming to the D. Young Museum. And we're talking about what it's like to represent your culture in the more dominant culture. It's pretty exciting. I also want to bring something up, that the film that actually you can go on YouTube and watch the film that the museum made, and it talks about the mining sites. And I'm always shocked because I know that Ilem is actually in the top 10 U.S. super sites for pollution. And I'm shocked that a lot of people don't know that living in Lake County and Mendocino County. And I would love to hear your take on how that is impacting our culture still to this day, because I think a lot of people don't know. This was the beginning of that. And like Sherry mentioned, there are four men in top hats in this painting that when you go see it, go to the exhibit and see it. And one of them was the mining man, the man who opened that mine and did a lot of poisoning of our people. Robert, if you want to talk about that, about what's going on with that site.
Currently I know EPA has came out and I know they're starting to interview a lot of the community and even the community around LM about, because there's been really just a lot of lip service about cleanup and how they're going to do it and what needs to happen. And the good thing that it's not just the native community that's tired of lip service. It's actually the, you know, non-native community that are around the outside that really have the concerns. And so they're really hard pressed. I think when it comes to doing something now about it, I think we're probably in a time with, you know, everything that's happened probably in the last 2 years, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen now. But, with what had happened, they started mining this poison, basically, it really was a game changer, I think, for everything. I mean, when we're talking, you know, we're talking basketry, we're talking, you know, things, even the animals are affected, you know, by it. What we eat and what we used to collect, you know, what we use for ceremony, those kind of things, everything was a part of it. And so, it's always on our mind. Like, what do we do, to be able, or what can be done, I think, to try to fix the problem. And a lot of people to understand it. It's not just an LM problem. And I'm glad that we as all, you know, indigenous communities, especially around the lake, realize that we're all affected by this. You know, the water doesn't stay just down in LM, you know, the fish don't stay just down in the vicinity of LM, the birds, you know. So, but, I'd definitely would like to have a Mio talk on that. I know the environmental, you know, portion of it, you know, she's the lady.
Sure, the lady, Mio. Just to let our listeners know that we are going to be taking questions in a few minutes. So if they have questions for our guests, Sherry Smith Ferry, Robert Gary, or Mio Marufo, please call 707-895-2448. Thank you. Go ahead, Mio. Take it away.
Again, I have to live up to these introductions. First, I'd like to say that I think that's probably the reason why we wanted to put so many different items with this painting. It was almost like combating what happened with this painting. This painting, and I'll try not to cry like I did in the movie, guys.
We love crying. It's fine.
I really, you know, we talked about this while we were filming the YouTube video, and I have to say that I didn't expect the emotion that this painting brought up, because they said, well, you know, what do you think of the time frame of this painting? And I didn't expect to have the emotional reaction I did. You know, part of me got really mad. This painting is not only a thing of beauty, this depicts the entire poisoning of a lake. You know, when we talk about a Superfund site for US EPA is where the site is so contaminated that so much money has to go into it and it becomes a Superfunder. And those types of sites rarely get cleaned. You know, when we're looking at this mine, you know, the mine tailings were put on the reservation. They were not just put on the reservation. They were put in the communities outside. What they, you know, the mine hit the reservation the hardest. But there are a bunch of non-Native communities all around that too. And when Robert was saying that those communities are starting to get angry too, is because those communities have been there long enough now to where they see the physiological effects of those Superfund sites. The reservation had the mine tailings right on, you know, and we're talking about, you know, cancer cells. We're talking about, you know, high infant mortality rates. We're talking about, hey, why are there lumps in the fish? You know, why are there different things like this happening? You know, what is creating mouth cancers when you're basket weaving? Things like that. And it's not just ELEM then that's getting affected by it. ELEM is taking the brunt of everything based on that mine proximity. The mine is right next to the reservation. I think it's important to note, though, that the culture did not end when that mine opened, that the culture remained. And it is still one of, see, I'm going to get emotional. See, but the culture still remains one of the strongest ones around that lake.
Oh.
And has been the backbone of the different things that have happened around that lake. So the culture didn't end when that mine opened, but it certainly made it a lot harder to survive and thrive. You know, the currents that are in that lake have made it so that the mine, the contaminations move around that lake. So there are things like, you can't eat fish. You can only eat 3 ounces of fish every 2 months.
Wow.
When you talk about a people that's sustained on fish, what does that do to them? It makes a fish people an acorn people. It changes songs. It changes language. It changes the very nature of some of our ceremonies of who we are, you know, for those who are down at the lake and deal with this water. You know, right now there are 7 tribes in Lake County. Those tribes have gotten together and they are now water sampling, water monitoring all around the lake. And Big Valley, ELEM, Upper Lake, and Robinson were the ones that kind of started that, and Scotts Valley is now in it. Lower Lake is in it. But initially, when these kind of things started, they were like, well, why aren't you just monitoring at your little reservation? And it's like, well, first of all, some of us don't touch the water, you know, with our reservation lands. But it's more, we're not just worried about one part of the lake, because it actually affects all of the lake, you know, so it has to, the monitoring has to move around. But this painting is the start of the contamination of the lake, because when that mine opened, that's when the contamination started happening. And these are the funders that are in the painting, you know, looking to fund the mine, you know, so it's a very powerful painting. And like Bob and Sherry said, it depicts just this whole time of what's going on with the people, the Pomo of the lake. You know, there's already all these things that are happening in that particular time frame to all of the Pomos, of, you know, all the Pomo tribes, you know, and all of the people of California, you know, just being 1870 something, you know. But then when you add in this whole idea of this one particular mine, you're affecting the whole of Pomo country in Lake County. Thank you,
Mio. That's good information. And so this show is called Good Ancestors and Local Treasures with Corinne Pierce, because you guys are amazing ancestors. Like, because you're going to make me cry. So, but I also want to inspire other people to be good ancestors, no matter what their race or heritage or background is. So knowing, like being aware that this is one of the top 10 Superfund sites in our own neighborhood, opens a door, I think, for a lot of people to be able to be good ancestors and to support good things. So I, again, I'm Corrine Pierce and I'm your host, and I have ancestry from Ilem, and I always, you know, I love that Mio is saying, you know, how resilient were these people to be being actively poisoned and still, being the center of culture and heritage for so many people, even as we were moved away from the lake. So we actually have a phone call, and this is my first phone call. So caller, you are joining us if you have a question for any of our hosts or any of our guests.
Yes. I just had to turn off the radio. Yes, I have been living here in Mendocino County for 30 years, and I am aware that Clear Lake was poisoned, but what kind of mine, what were they mining for? And is I need, if you could give me a little more history, because I feel like you guys already know it all, and I'm coming in fresh. So,
it was a mercury mine.
Excuse me?
It was a mercury mine, correct, Mio? It was for mercury, correct?
Oh, okay. And do you have the history, do you know the name of Clear Lake, is it, what was the indigenous name for it, and how did it become called Clear Lake?
Clear Lake's one of, if not the oldest lake in North America, and this is a great time for a history lesson. There are several Pomo quote, I'm going to put some air finger quotes here. There are several Pomo languages around that lake. There was not just one name for that lake. Each of those indigenous groups would have had their own name and way of referencing that. So I know that Mio and Robert both do language, and they are across the lake from each other, so they actually speak different languages from each other. So if they want to share in their language what the name for their lake is, that would be wonderful. Don't jump all at once.
Well, see, I'm like sitting here with my hand shaking because I'm a dabbler. Bob is a speaker. I'm a dabbler. Hobbiton is what I've always known it as. So you want to pronounce that right for me, Bob?
Yeah, it's, well, my mom, just for clarification too, my mom's Eastern Pomo, she's from Big Valley. So I kind of got that both, but yeah, I noticed like down here, our pronunciation is a little bit different, but my mom's was Hobbiton, which is like Mio, the same, Eastern Pomo. And then down here is just Hobbiton, which just means big water. That was their indigenous name for the lake, usually by all the tribes that were from here. I think the only one that might have named it different would have been the Wapo at some point. But yeah, other than that, it was the same.
Thank you, guys. That was cool. That was our first caller. So we only have a couple of minutes left. So I'm wondering if there are any passion projects that you guys are working on right now that you would like to share with our listeners before we sign off for the morning. I know Sherry is working on an amazing exhibit down in Healdsburg, and I would love to hear about that.
Thank you. Yes, I'm working feverishly because I only have a few more weeks. I'm getting an exhibit finished about Dry Creek Rancheria history and culture called From Digger's Bend to River Rock down at the Healdsburg Museum. It'll open on September 30th and it will be up until the end of May in 2022. And It's for all of you that are basket lovers, it's the first chance that I've ever had to bring together baskets from that region that are of Pomo country that are really spectacular and different. So everybody had kind of their own unique style. So
awesome. Thank you so much. And we are out of time. I'm so grateful to the three of you for being here on my inaugural show of Good Ancestors and Local Treasures with Corinne Pierce. Thank you so much, everybody. And I will see you all soon.
This podcast was produced by KZYX-FM, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, local community radio from Mendocino County, California. If you enjoyed the program and you'd like to hear more, in Northern California, you can tune in anytime to KZYX at 90.7 FM in Philo, KZYZ at 91.5 FM in Willits and Ukiah, and 88.1 FM in Fort Bragg. If you're listening to this podcast from further away, we also stream live 24 hours a day at kzyx.org, where you can hear our eclectic range of locally produced music, public affairs, and news, along with daily state and national news programs and breaking news. You can also find out how to become a member to keep KZYX on the air. Thank you for listening.